What the hell is going on?
I don't want to set the world on fire.
I think she just gave me my cold open. Welcome to GCP Bites, episode number 9 for Friday, the 31st of January, 2025. At GCP Bites, we have no idea what's going on, just like the rest of the world. And I am your host, Stephen Bancroft. On today's show, there's a new head of chip technology at Google. Google reveals why there are so many cloud attacks. And the AI wars goes nuclear with a new player, and it sends shockwaves and stocks take a tumble. Find out more in the AI wars. But before we get to any of that, I'd like to introduce the co-host of the show, Dave Wall. How are you going, Dave?
I'm good, mate. I'm trying to pull myself together after your intro.
And our very own GDE, Ian Brown. How are you, Ian?
I'm good, mate. How are you?
Wait, I just had to tell it like it is, because
it was such a cracker. It had Dave and I both in stitches.
It's nice when like a whole load of super interesting stuff comes out like the day before the podcast recording, right?
Oh, just boy. Throw
out what we were planning.
We had all this stuff planned. Some of it's interesting because it's thrown us into a spin. Imagine if you were someone that's just dropped $1 billion in investment, and then this happens. We'll get on to exactly what, but they would really be in a head spin at the moment.
Oh yes,
yeah. So I don't want to say too much at the moment. When we get to the conversation, we'll talk about it. But it's certainly been an interesting week in a lot of ways. Let's just quickly talk about tech adventures. What have you guys been up to in terms of tech adventures? Anything interesting?
Nothing too much on my side. Like, sort of so busy with work, so it's mostly been kind of building and tinkering with my 3D printer farm. That's probably taking the most of my time at the moment.
Always, yeah.
Nothing exciting there.
I think the last part of my laser cutter might arrive today.
Mm.
Aramax has got it, so you know. Ooh. It might arrive today, and so that's going to be my fun for the weekend.
Now that's exciting.
Yeah.
That's
laser cutter, and then my young fella has decided that, and he's always known that he wants to get into agriculture of some description, whether it's grazing or agriculture proper farming
or hydroponics,
or some sort of farming.
Not that sort.
No. And we were talking the other day, we went around to friends' places and we were talking and they were talking about, you know, that one of their mates has just dropped like $35,000 on this robotic weeder that has a micro spray that comes down and sprays the weed with poison and moves on.
Oh, cool.
And I was like, that's cool, but wouldn't it be simpler to do it with a laser? Mm. Because a laser would kill the weed instantly.
Zap it.
You wouldn't have to worry about like the poison taking effect and then overspray the poison on potentially the crop.
I know I've seen like the council guys here using both like flame weeders and mm-hmm. steam. They have like a steam one, which I think that's pretty cool. And there's a big sign on the side of the truck because I guess people get concerned, like, oh, what are you spraying? And it's like, it's just steam, guys. Yeah. Like, it's just, don't worry, it's literally water.
Just boiling water.
but it wouldn't be a stretch to put that on some sort of jig that just rolls along with a camera and then have a model on there to identify the weed, and then it just aims the laser
Raspberry Pis have actually got an AI module now.
Mm.
And Maddie was like, oh, so can we just sort of start building something like this? And I'm like, we can look at it.
Mm.
Like, there's no reason why we can't.
Of course not.
So that's going to be my tech adventure for like probably the next year or until he gets bored with it in 6 weeks' time and decides he doesn't want to do it anymore.
But it's good to have like an actual project. Like, hey, I think this is something that people might like, or at least, you know, would be interesting for yourself.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, just building the code out for it is going to be phenomenally interesting because I've never done anything like that before.
Plus, I guess the benefit of if you were programming it for a specific crop, right? It's like, okay, we're growing, I don't know, tomatoes. Right?
Yeah.
So you kind of just really need to model this is what tomato looks like and kill everything else.
Yep. But the plan that I had very roughly was we get a database of common weeds in Australia because every council website has, or every government, like state government website has a, these are considered weeds in our state.
Oh, yeah, of course, because not everything is a weed everywhere.
That's right. So mountain ash is a prime example. So in Queensland, mountain ash is a weed. It's a tree that just grows prolifically. It's a horrible, horrible tree to get out. It takes years and years and years of killing it and cutting it down and all the rest of it to get rid of it.
Mm.
But in New South Wales, it's fine.
Well, I had a bit of a tech adventure during the fortnight. I happened to come by an old production studio that was shutting down, and I managed to acquire a lot of their old equipment.
Very nice.
You had my interest. Now you have my attention.
Now, this is what I was really after. I got a bunch of these MOTU sound cards.
Mark of the Unicorn.
Yeah, I've got four of those. That's what I was really after. But along for the ride came seven Mac G5s.
Oh, wow.
I've got seven of them.
Right? Seven.
Seven. They're over here. And a bunch of, I mean, they're almost useless. And a bunch of like old software and everything. And some old hardware and bits and pieces. I've gone through a lot of it. A lot of it I've chucked out. A lot of it is going to be e-waste. But those four sound cards I've got, if you're going to buy them on eBay, maybe $200 or $300 each. So I was happy with that. There's another like plug-in thing that I had to, like a PCIe card that I had to buy. That will connect to those and integrate all my studio gear into the computer. So that's a little project I'm doing at the moment.
I know Motu makes, they make like switches as well, like network switches, but are, you know, designed for an audio use case. You know, obviously, I make some mounts for them, but I don't use them.
Yep.
And I think it's to do with more like, I guess, if devices that you're converting to Ethernet to run.
Yeah, so there's an audio over Ethernet protocol called Dante.
That sounds familiar.
Yeah, so what you can do is you can have, say, on a big audio desk, mixing desk, you can have a single network Dante network port, run that over Ethernet, and then at the other end you have a breakout box and it gives you all your audio interfaces and that. You
can
run
96/128
channels kind of thing. Yeah, it's for like live shows and things like that where you might have like a full orchestra, stuff on stage, and then you've got the front of house desk at the back of the auditorium, and they don't want to run, you know, 128 lines of audio. They just run one single network, or they plug into the network and run it down that way.
I think the young fella's school hall has got that because they've got a massive electronic mixing desk in the sort of three quarters of the way back, and it's all digital. There's very little of it. It's the old school sliders and.
Yeah, that's right. But you know, there's a trend at the moment to go back to what they call analog summing.
Okay.
So, something that I'm going to tinker with is outing all my audio lines into an old school, like from the 80s analog desk, right? Do the summing in the desk and then shoot it back into the computer. The reason for that is the analog summing gives a much nicer sound, much more warmth and depth, and you get artifacts like crosstalk between the two channels. I mean, you'd be familiar with crosstalk in telephony, where a little bit of the sound or ground loop from one channel leaks into the other channel. Now, that's technically not desirable, you know, but from the result that you get out, it can actually result in a much nicer sound, much less sterile sound, which is kind of what you want if you're after some nice music, right?
Gotcha. Yeah. So it's a little bit, I mean... in a visual sense, you know, you have like ray tracing. And so it's like you see the thing, but you also kind of want to see the reflections of it, and the reflections of it in elsewhere adds context.
Yeah, you want it to be dirtied up a little bit, right? If it's too perfect, it doesn't look right.
Right, because if I was talking to you face to face, I would hear the sound coming out of your mouth, and I would also hear it bouncing off various surfaces back in. So I'm, and my brain's filtering it properly, but that's what it's supposed to sound like. And crosstalk is kind of a similar thing. You're getting more context because you're hearing it in different places.
Yeah, it sort of smooshes the sound up a little bit, and it's not so clinical, right? And it just kind of adds this warmth to it. Plus, you've got all the analog circuitry, right? If you're purely digital, if you're doing everything in the box and it's purely digital, you know, the high ends tend to spit at you, and you can end up with this technically too perfect sound. Whereas if you just sort of throw it all in the analog circuitry, it kind of smooshes it all up and you get this analog warmth, and the high ends is sort of, there's not so much. And it, because it's a little bit more difficult to control, it ends up with a sort of a more human sound, right?
Cool.
So that's kind of one of my tech adventures, and this is a path this has led me on, getting these sound cards. And, you know, I got one of those G5s. Of course, couldn't help it. I had to put Linux on one of them.
I know a young fella who'll buy one off you.
he can have one, mate. He can have one. I got seven of them here.
Right.
You can put, they've got 8 DIMM slots. You can put 2 gig 4600 DDR RAM into them.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can have 16 gig max.
They're also just, the chassis are really nice. So if you wanted to rebuild something else in the case, they're gorgeous.
They're bulletproof. Yeah. Heavy bloody beasts of a thing. Now I'm actually really keenly interested because there's a underground operating system called Morph OS.
Cool.
And so Morph OS is a PowerPC operating system. Designed and intended to look like the old Amiga OS from the 80s and 90s. It can run through some shims classic Amiga software.
Yeah, nice.
Right, so this has got me interested. So I definitely want to set one of those up with this Morph OS. And I got a couple of ATI X1900 video cards as well, so you can take out the crappy NVIDIA one that they put in there and put in a accelerated 3D card, and it'll take advantage of all that as well. So that'll be another.
That's going to be quite the adventure.
That'll be quite pretty cool. Yeah, I did manage to get Linux onto one of them, so I know how to use my Open Boot and to boot off flash drives and all this stuff. So I'm into that now. So that was part of the hurdle that I had to jump. But it should be cool.
Should be a bit more forgiving as well than your Commodore 64 adventures, right? Like
that's stalled at the moment because I'm getting some work done on the house, and the room where I want to put it currently doesn't have any walls.
So kind of necessity.
Yeah, so I don't want to go building up this thing when I've got actually nowhere to put it when it's all done. So
that's one way to do open hardware.
So very soon that'll be finished, and I'll give you an update on the Commodore 64 adventure. Cool. All right. Well, should we get on with the show?
Probably.
Let's do it.
All right. Let's do it. A couple of quick news items here before we get on with the main news items. We've got Aussie Broadband. Someone's retired, Ian.
Yeah. Philip Britt, who is the one of the co-founders. He's current group managing director as well. Has announced his retirement, and he will officially retire as CEO on the 28th of Feb. He is following his the other co-founder, John Reisinger, who retired in, I think it was October last year, perhaps, or maybe it was December, I can't remember. But he retired last year. So the two co-founders of the company are now retired. And the CFO, Brian Mayer, will step in as the CEO. Effective on the 1st of March.
Right, which I think he's already been the Aussie Broadband CEO, but this is him taking on the actual group level, like the higher level.
Yeah. Yep.
I mean, Aussie Broadband are pretty good. I can't see, you know, hopefully they don't make much changes to their branding or the way they go to market, because I think everyone's pretty happy with that at the moment.
Pretty happy with Aussie Broadband,
Yeah, very.
I think they're the number five largest ISP in Australia now.
Yep, I'm with them, and yeah, they've been excellent, really. Especially when, you know, the tech nerd rings up and says, I want you to remove all your firewalls and all your blocks in place. And they go, yeah, sure, no worries.
Yeah, the only one for me is the CG NAT when you first enable it.
Yeah, no, you just got to opt in for the – it's $5 a month. Get yourself static IP.
Get yourself static. That's what I did. Yeah.
No more CG NAT for you.
No, well, I mean, if you don't have the static, they will turn off CG NAT for you. You just have to put a support call in for it.
Yep.
But, I mean, yes, I have a static as well.
Yeah.
That's right. That's right. And we have finally container registry going away.
Yeah,
been talking about it for a while.
Yeah, we've been talking about it for ages, but – effectively, on the 25th of March, container registry will be replaced with artifact registry. And Google's put out a really helpful tool there that that checks your GCR usage. So you can go to the link and for each of the projects, it'll show you how to check for usage of GCR. And that way you can migrate those images over to artifact registry. And this will also affect Cloud Run functions still using GCR as well.
Yeah, all right. Well, if you're using Cloud Run, probably worthwhile going in and doing a little bit more investigation on that one. All right, cool. Well, let's get on with the community news. And Ian, once again, you being our stand-in, well, not stand-in, being the GDE.
He's a stand-up.
Stand-up GDE, representing, you threw a couple of these in here. What have we got?
Cool. So GDG Sydney is doing a meetup. That's going to be at the Metal Group headquarters in Sydney. It's on the 4th of Feb from 4:30. And this event is visualizing big data with BigQuery and Google Looker Studio. And a second talk is about modernizing web scraping using a self-hosted LLM to extract data from almost any website. So I actually like the sound of both of them and wouldn't mind going. I'll have to talk to Gishan and see if he can live stream it for me. And then the next one is a Google AI for Science. In Australia, it's Notebook LM as a tool for research and education. And this is an online event that you can RSVP to. It's actually put on by Google. And the speaker is Stephen Johnson, who's an editorial director at Google.
Nice. So
well worth a look in.
Mm-hmm. All right. That's it for community news. Let's get on with the news items. And first news item for this week is Microsoft VP of Silicon Engineering jumps to Google Cloud to head chip technology and manufacturing. Yeah, we've had some moves here. Microsoft former Vice President of Silicon Manufacturing Engineering, Rian Sheik, I guess, has left to join.
That's right. Yeah,
has left to join rival cloud to Google Cloud to become one of the company's leading silicon chip leaders. So he's got a bit of a long history,
very storied history.
Wow, 24-year stint at Intel, where he was responsible for leading silicon engineering productization.
Yeah, so you can see why Microsoft picked him up.
Yeah,
back then.
Yeah.
But he led the Cobalt processor engineering for Azure. So, I mean, that's a fair step.
Yeah, and their AI accelerator, Maya.
Oh, yeah.
So like, he's done a lot of work there. And I can see now, like, I can see why Microsoft grabbed him, and I can see why Google obviously made him a very attractive offer.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, Google's like own chip development's been doing wonderful things over the last couple of years, as we've well covered on the show. So, I'm sure he's going into very fertile ground.
Yeah.
Absolutely, yeah, and going to turn it up to 11, I'd imagine. Well, best of luck to him, and can't wait to see what comes out of Google's chip manufacturing as a result. A bit more Australian IT news. NBN Co. Impacted by storms in New South Wales. And I can tell you what, we had some big storms here. It rained like I've never seen before. I'm pretty sure I saw Noah and his ark go floating by at one point. yeah, boy, wasn't it big?
Yeah, there's definitely some big storms down there. The article was stating as of January 19th, they're talking about 36,500 homes were still impacted with network disruptions, which is 4 days after the weather sort of disappeared. Interestingly, all the links there on about Telstra's outage finder and the Essential Energy Networks outages, they're all dead links now. So they must delete the notice of outage after it's been rectified.
Oh, right. It's not just outage site. It was to a specific one.
It's to a specific outage and that's gone.
We didn't have any interruptions to NBN here, but we did have a power outage for quite a number of hours on the Friday night when that big storm hit, and we were sitting here with candles and, singing kumbayas. So
very romantic. Yeah. Bottle of wine and...
What do you do when the power goes out?
Like, yeah, that's it.
No, I just keep going because I got a battery.
we kick on the generator and off we go. We do have, because we've got battery backup on all the local infrastructure in here. So we've got for the NBN and the Proxmox cluster and everything. That's all battery backed. So our Wi-Fi stays up and the internet stays up and all the rest. It's all then just a case of how long is the outage going on, and if it goes on for more than 2 hours, then we break out the generator and plug the fridges in.
A couple of stories coming out of Google with some new things that they've got. Google Workspace enables the future of AI-powered work for every business.
Yeah, this is really good. This is nice that this is switched on. So this is now, like, they've actually enabled Gemini on pretty much every, I think it's every, but certainly in mine, every Workspace account. And I think they're putting our prices up by like $2 a user, but it's mm-hmm. significantly cheaper than, I think it was 20 initially to have any of these services switched on, which.
No, so the Gemini business add-on was $32 per user per month.
Yeah. Well, I think we complained about that on the show and just said no one's going to go for it at that price.
Ludicrous amounts of money.
Yeah.
Yeah, I used like the trial a couple of – like I turned the trial on and then I would turn it off and then it would give me another trial. So I did that a couple of times.
Yeah.
But it is very nice having Gemini in everywhere. And for little things, like even like in Meet, we were using it the other day when we were having our planning meeting, and it's just, it does the transcript, but it also made notes. And yes, notes weren't perfect. Like, I know it's got a little bit confused on something that Ian said, or what the banky said, but I was sort of rereading it. And I mean, how many meetings, especially probably when you were more like kind of junior in your careers, right? When you get tasked with like, being the person to take the minutes in a meeting. That's the worst, right? And there's mistakes and stuff that happens when someone's doing it, especially if it's someone who doesn't really know the team or know the technical discussions. So I thought it was pretty good.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's good.
That's good, yeah. You can get your AI assistant in Google Docs, Gmail, Sheets, Meet, Chat, Vids, and more. Chat with Gemini Advanced. You can chat with it directly in there, and you can use Notebook LM Plus.
Yeah. Now that actually is relevant to the community news thing that you just went through, Ian. Right. Yeah. So it's like a lot of people are now going to have access to Notebook LM Plus. So it's a good idea to go and attend that course and learn, how you can use it for scientific purposes.
Hmm.
Yeah, exactly right.
Doing some number crunching with that. Fantastic.
I did like the safeguards that they've got around it too. So further down in the article that they're talking about is how they're safeguarding the interactions with AI. So the old your data is your data thing. We're not going to take your data and use it to train the model outside of your domain without your permission. And and they don't sell it for ads or anything like that. And then the enterprise grade controls they've got around it, so it protects all your sensitive data. And then it's, again, it's also ISO 27001 and SOC 1, 2, and 3 and ISO 42001 compliant.
Yeah, so it's real good. I mean, and this is the reason why we kind of pay for some Google services, right? You get the free ones and, yeah, they can use that data. But, you know, if you're an enterprise or a business customer, like, yeah, they know how to keep that separate.
Yeah, that's right.
So, yeah, very, very happy that that's there now. The only thing that I would like would be if I could pull my YouTube Premium into my Workspace account. That'd be the only major thing that I want left now.
Yeah. I do like my YouTube Premium.
Yeah.
I've avoided it. But anyway, all right. And moving on, next one, cloud migrations made easy. A guide to migrating from AWS to Google Cloud. Who put this in here?
This was me. Yeah, this is InfraMod. So this is right up. It's right up all of our alleys because we're all InfraMod guys. But this is right up my alley because I've done this before, and we all know AWS is garbage, legacy cloud, and all that. But what Google's done is they put together a whole heap of articles on how to migrate from various different AWS services. And we all know that there's a bazillion of them into the relevant Google service. So, for instance, they've got EC2 to Compute Engine and VMware VMs to GCVE, which we know and love, and Amazon's EKS into GKE. The one that I sort of picked out of this one because I'm looking at it at the moment is AWS Lambda to Cloud Run.
That's the one that caught my attention too.
Yeah, so it's... Look, it's not a tool to do this. It's a process. And they've literally documented out the entire process that you need to follow in order to migrate your AWS Lambda function or container into Cloud Run.
Mm. This is perfect. Like if you're your DevOps guy and you've got to write some sort of change plan to do these migrations, this is your one-stop shop for the whole thing, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's... The whole thing is there. It walks you through step by step what needs to happen at a high level, so that you can just make sure that the destination is ready to go and just swap it over.
Love it.
Yeah, I think it's a fantastic doc by Google.
Yeah, it's a really nice collection, especially when you start talking like Lambda or like Redshift to BigQuery. When you're shifting from not just kind of simple things like a VM or a Compute Engine sort of instance, right, to actual services that are similar but not open standards.
There's a paradigm difference. Yeah.
So for instance, with the Lambda stuff, and this was the one that really caught my attention on how detailed this doc is. So they've got a table in the doc around designing the migration. And it lists the AWS Lambda features and then the Cloud Run features in a column. And it shows you there that, like, rightio, you want to migrate, for instance, an asynchronous invocation out of AWS Lambda. That becomes a cloud task. And you want scheduled invocation, that's Cloud Scheduler. If it uses Amazon SQS or SNS integration, then that's PubSub. So it gives you all of those, hey, this needs to use XYZ features. They map to this service.
Go check it out. I'll put the link there in the show notes. It's a blog article, but inside the blog article, there's links off to all the individual tech instructions to do your transpositions. All right, on to a couple of security items. We have the Google Cloud. Google report reveals rising cloud data security threats. Now, this is interesting. Google Security has published its H1 2025 Threat Horizons report, identifying escalating threats in the cloud environments. posed by threat actors. Now, they tend to do this, what, is it every quarter or every year? I forget now.
Every half year.
H1. But yes, ransomware and data threats in the cloud are not new, but what they have identified is that a large number of the attacks come from hybrid environments. Google Cloud Research has also identified that the exploitation of user identities in hybrid environments is resulting in persistent access and lateral movements between on-prem and cloud environments. You know what? That doesn't come as a surprise.
Not at all.
Yeah. You think about it. You've got these hybrid environments where you have Google on one side with a zero trust environment and then this old daggy old hybrid environment with, you know, who knows what used for authentication.
Everybody's trusted from everywhere to everywhere.
Because you've had, you know, 20 different half-run projects over the years to modernize your firewalls and securities, and then people got bored of that project and moved on.
And then guess what? You put a VPN between the two that just opens the two up. So it's not surprised that it's happening from on-prem.
I know at work we've got a... issues with that. We've got Palo Alto firewalls in our data center, and we're trying desperately to get out of our data center. It's happening, but it's a slow process, as is the case with all big platforms. But I was horrified when I first came on board that there was rules that allowed any between the staging and production.
No, that's
you don't do that. That's bad. Yeah. Bad juju.
Yeah, but it makes it easier to run then. We don't want any blockers.
You're slowing us down.
There's lots of people that don't like us because our cloud firewalls are already monstrous because the default rule is deny everything. And
of course.
And devs, staging and prod are all separate networks, separate VPCs that are not connected at all. Mm. They have separate connections back to the data center.
This is the way.
And so when you get groups at work go, oh, we just need dev to talk to prod. No, I'm sorry. It can't happen.
You know, the biggest thing that I find in those legacy style firewalls is the decommissioning, right? People pull boxes out and, oh, that's it, the app shut down, but they never go back and, you know, fix up the infrastructure. They never pull the rules out.
Yep.
That's the number one thing. The rules just stay there and it ends up this being this huge thing and no one knows what any of the stuff's doing.
Yep.
Yeah. And then you'll migrate systems and you go, well, we better move all the rules across.
No.
And it's because the reason for that is because when you shut down the system initially, you go, rightio, the system's getting shut down and in a month's time, I'm going to delete the VM and then I'll delete all the rules at the same time. And then
doesn't happen.
Someone
like
else picks up that ticket a month later and goes, oh, the ticket just says to delete the VM. So I've deleted the VM and hasn't thought about it and gone, oh, hang on. I probably need to look at if the rules are still in place in the firewall.
It's like, no, that's another guy's problem.
They don't know what the rules were, right? They're not labeled properly or other things we're using those. You know, they just don't know. So just leave it there.
It might be important. Right. I don't want to cause an outage. Or just you go like, oh yeah, I will get to that. But meanwhile, there's some other really important thing, you know, and there's only so much time in the day.
Yeah, that's right.
And then after a few years of that, it becomes a big mess.
Yeah.
And then no, these are critical for there's business reasons we need that firewall rule to be. It's like it hasn't been used.
Yeah.
Ever.
We've got rules in cloud firewall now that have never been hit. And I'm looking at them now going, well, I'm going to remove them because that means
nice.
There's no point
having them up. Clean them up. Reset the hit counters.
Yep.
And then, you know, after 2 weeks, if nothing hasn't been hit, it can go.
Yep.
And then if, you know, if it hasn't been used in 2 weeks, well, we can deal with the fallout of that particular problem.
There's worse than that. There's rules that I think should have been hit but haven't, which means that there's another rule in there that is
taking precedence.
There's an allow that's higher up.
I need to squash because that will likely
rule.
Yeah, it will likely be allowing more access because you know there's layers in the firewall.
Yeah, what you got to do is those rules that are tighter.
Mm.
You push them up in the processing order. And then the idea is eventually the really permissive rules should get to zero in their hits.
Yeah.
And then you can remove the permissive rules. That's the approach I've taken. But it takes a long time.
It does. It takes ages because you've just got to keep going through the SEC and keep going through the firewall, like all the layers of firewalls to figure out what's being hit and what's not. Like there's rules in there that have got hundreds of thousands of hits on it that I think should probably have maybe 100 hits on it, and rules in there that have got zero that should have hundreds.
Yeah, far too permissive if you've got that many that quickly. And, of course, the other vector for attacks is weak credentials, and particularly weak credentials on cloud databases. The next security story, we'll talk about weak credentials as well. But, welcome one and password are not acceptable passwords on your database.
No. It's okay because I used an at instead of an A, and I used two fives instead of the S's.
Wrote it in leet. Okay, fine.
Yeah. But my question here is, if you're using a cloud database, like let's say you're using Cloud SQL, why are you using passwords to start with? It supports token authentication.
Because that's the way we've always done it, Ian. And that's the way we'll continue to do it.
I couldn't make it work first time, so I just set a password and then it worked. So great. Project complete. Yeah.
Yep. This is it.
How to undo all the security that we put into the environment in one easy step. Open the database up to the world. Easier.
And then to make it really easy, I put the credential in the Git repository.
Oh, yeah.
So that was good. So everyone could, it was very helpful.
Yeah. Very helpful for everyone. And then to follow on from that, another article from Cyber Security Dive, Google Cloud links poor credentials to nearly half of all cloud-based attacks. The TLDR are cloud service accounts with weak or non-existent credentials were the most common entry points for attackers in the second half of 2024. Attacks involving weak or no credential accounts for nearly half of the intrusions. Misconfigurations in cloud services were the second most common. So, public buckets, things like that. Initial access vectors representing more than one in three attacks.
So this comes back to basic security again, like super, super basic levels of security in that. Okay, Google gives you a level of Security Command Center for free in every project that you have.
Use it
because it will tell you if you've got an open firewall rule. It'll tell you if you've got a misconfigured account. It will tell you all of that information for nothing. It's money for jam.
And I tell you what, I did a project, an audit recently for one of our clients, and it was as simple as that.
Yep.
A big component of it was going into SCC, seeing what was there, and then transcribing that into a document that the customer could consume. And they went, great, if we do that. And I said to them, if you do these steps, you will be infinitely more secure.
Yep. So that's one side of it. But then when you have to let, because everybody has a public service of some description in Google Cloud, if you are letting something in from the internet through a firewall rule that allows allows 0/0 on whatever ports into a specific GCE instance or a Cloud Run or a GKE cluster or whatever, then don't put your database on the same machine, because if the machine gets compromised, everything's compromised. It's called a
tiered architecture. We've had this since the 90s, right?
Yeah.
This idea.
It's a marvelous idea. It's been around for decades, and yet we still don't follow it because it's cheaper and easier to put it all on one box.
Yeah, because I can use a SQLite database so quick.
Yeah. No one ever. Look, honestly, the fundamentals training for all cloud providers, and I've done all of them, I think the fundamentals training needs to be far more in-depth on this is the security that you need to attain in order to be reasonably secure in the cloud or anywhere, really, because the same, like this is not new to the cloud. This is just easier to do in the cloud.
Yeah, and here's the thing. It's like having a car alarm on your car, right? the criminal's going to come up and look at your car, see the flashing light, and go, eh, too much trouble. I'll go on to the next car that doesn't have the car alarm. So if you do these things, these security, you take these security precautions, the you know, it's going to be a lot more difficult for the, you know, the flyby hacker to have a go at it, and they go, too hard. I'll move on to the next guy.
Yeah, exactly.
You start moving from opportunistic hacking to targeted malicious hacking, right?
Yeah.
So,
I
actually did think it was quite interesting that, especially because of how much money is spent in security and improving security services, right? And still, the majority of issues are just because you got a terrible password that's got too much access in too many places.
That's exactly right.
And an open bucket. It's like I've got something that's too permissive and access that's too lax, which are so bottom of the barrel issues, and yet it's the majority of the problem. So forget the billions of dollars spent on like Mandiant acquisition and all that kind of stuff.
We implement a least privilege model at work. It's just the best practice. So that's what you do. We are now ISO 27001 compliant. So all of that stuff gets implemented from the get-go, and anybody who wants to circumvent that finds out very quickly that they can't, because they don't control the credentials. We do, and the credentials get least privilege. So if we need to do something like, okay, we had to create a custom role the other day, what we did was give the project, without telling them that, we gave them the admin roles. And then came back a week later and ran the recommender over that user account or that service account. And then Google told us, hey, this has got like 3,000 excess permissions. Cool. Mm-hmm. Rip them out. Mm-hmm. And created a custom role and ripped them all out.
And get rid of them. Yep.
Yep.
Just have the custom role. Yeah, it's the way to go.
Easiest thing to do.
Yeah, that's very clever. So I guess you could kind of do that in like a dev environment and go, okay, well, here's the thing. And then go, great, well, I know now what you're going to need in prod. And you can sanity check that smaller list and go, actually, you turned this thing on, but you really shouldn't have done that. So
they can't turn things on in our environment. So if you want to create a project and do something in Google, in certainly, definitely in production, but in all environments, at work, you need to submit a Google form to us that says, hey, I want this environment. Here's the owners of the environment. Here's the APIs I need access to. And here's the communications that it's going to need to be able to do. So it's going to need to be able to communicate with this service on this port, and this service on this port, and this service is going to need to communicate with us on this port. And so we build out the firewall rules. We give them the service account with those exact permissions. And it's all done. No one can turn on APIs without us doing it for them.
And that's all done with a pipeline. So if you want to rip it all out later, it's easy to go back and rip it out.
Well, it's all done in Terraform. So if the entirety of Sydney disappears off the face of the earth, then Melbourne will be spun up in a matter of minutes.
Because Terraform, how come you're not open tofu yet?
Well, I am. But, I am. There's some other people that it's a diehard situation here.
Let's not go down that rabbit hole. All right. Look, before we get on with the AI wars, we thought we might just talk about Intel because it is kind of relevant. Intel stock on the 17th of January, 17th, 18th of January, went up for a change, shot up.
Yeah.
And why did that happen? Well, apparently there's an unknown stakeholder sniffing around.
Yeah,
and we don't know who yet.
There's rumored to be a consortium, possibly with some certain well-heeled individuals backing them.
Right. so that was very interesting that it shot up, but then it quickly took a nosedive again. And then on the 27th of January, which we will get onto, everything took a nosedive. So let's do it. Let's get on with the AI war. AI. Oh boy, and we've got to talk about it straight off the top. What the hell is going on with DeepSeek? The world has gone crazy. Everything's gone nuclear. DeepSeek is just taking a chunk out of everyone.
Yeah, this time last week, never heard of DeepSeek before.
Like, it didn't exist as far as anyone was aware, and then all of a sudden this thing comes in, drops the bombshell that, hey, we've got this model that competes with OpenAI's ChatGPT-4.
We trained it for $5 million.
Yeah, and it only cost us $6 million to build.
Let's just bring everyone up to date. In case you've been in Mars in a cave
living
with your fingers
in
your ears and you've been living under a rock, a Chinese company has released a new AI model called DeepSeek. It's an app. You can go on your phone right now and download it. And they've trained, well, I thought I had the numbers on it here. They've trained a 60 billion parameter model,
671 billion parameters.
171, right. Yep. And they trained it for $5 million or something, yep. Something stupid, some stupid small amount of money.
Yeah, they did that because they didn't buy all the NVIDIA chips. Like, they couldn't, no. Right? It's a Chinese company. They wouldn't be able to buy these specific chips because of the embargoes. But they were able to, you know, pay for the tokens to be able to run it on, I think, NVIDIA's cluster.
Yeah, right.
So they've done it for a fraction of the cost, and it outperforms everything at the moment. It's just knocking it for six. Of course, you know, China doing something cheaper comes as no surprise. But as a result, on the 27th, all the tech stocks took a nosedive, including NVIDIA, which lost $593 billion in one day, which is the largest loss of any stock in history.
Yeah. That's too many billions, not more billions. Yeah. More billions were worse.
And in this case, more billions is not better. I did read, though. So Microsoft security researchers observed individuals they believe connected to DeepSeek exfiltrating large amounts of data using OpenAI's API. So what they're insinuating here is, and they're investigating, that potentially DeepSeek is using OpenAI's data to train their models.
That's exactly what they did. Mm. So I'll link to a video in Dave's garage, and he breaks it down quite well.
Okay.
The reason they were able to do this is because it was a train-the-trainer kind of situation. They used all the current models, GPT, Gemini, Lambda, et cetera, and they used those models to train their model. That's really why they were able to do it right. So cheaply. It's like the next generation, right? So you want to learn something, you go to an instructor, right? You want to learn to play tennis, you could either go out with a tennis racket and fumble around and try and learn the game yourself, right? Which is what the first generation of AI models were doing. Or you could go to an instructor and he can immediately tell you what you need to do.
We stand on the shoulders of giants.
Standing on the shoulders of giants. And that's exactly what they've done here. They've used the previous models to train their new models, and they've just picked the essence out of the old models, and they've got this new hyper slim, hyper trained next generation of model. It's akin to what Dave in Dave's Garage talks about. He says, you know, in the 60s and 70s and then early 80s, you had mainframes and supercomputers, right? And they were the go-to. But then the late 80s, the microcomputer and the home computer came along, and they really highly optimized what a computer was, and they just picked the essence out of it, and suddenly you had millions of little computers in everyone's house, in everyone's homes. It's the same kind of transformation that's occurring now.
Yep.
Yeah, and DeepSeek have open sourced the model, not the training data, but like the model, and in different levels. So you can run it on increasingly small machine. You can run it on a Raspberry Pi.
Absolutely, yeah.
Which is very cool.
I did see on DeepSeek's site, they've got a blog post there about DeepSeek R1 hard code round one test results, and it's like the ADA coding standard rankings. Competition begins with notable standings in the ADA coded standing. OpenAI's O1 holds the top position. DeepSeek R1 secured second place, showing significant improvement from 45 to 52%. And Claude 3.5 Sonnet ranked below R1 and DeepSeek 3 positioned after Sonnet. So, I mean, they're like, none of them are perfect, but wow, that does show just how well they've trained that model right from the outset.
And yeah, I think you can see, like, as you said before, Banky, like, you know, there's criticism that, oh, well, they've used OpenAI's data to help train their model. It's like, yeah, but OpenAI, like, you know, has been very rightly criticized for the amount of everybody else's data that they use to train their model. Right. So, like, oh, I'm so sorry. Like, I drink your milkshake. Drainage, my boy.
Yeah, this is the thing. Like, and then another model's going to come along and use DeepSeek to train itself. You know, this is I think this is the way it's going to go forward now.
Yeah, and I think yes, Nvidia's pulled back because their valuation was insane because they can't make enough chips and everybody wants them. I don't see why this beyond just, you know, being just a bit of a market pullback, which was overheated. I don't really see why DeepSeek coming out with this model really actually impacts NVIDIA. Like, yes, it will run on smaller sets, but that just means that the hardware that is there can now be used more efficiently. You can still train bigger things. Like, NVIDIA is still going to be selling chips. It's not going to be like, okay, well, we have enough now. We've got enough Tensor cores. We're good.
No, you're absolutely right. They're going to still be selling chips, right. And there'll be the next generation of chips, right?
Correct.
There's always going to be a need for those.
So your other AI companies, your OpenAIs, etc., like, yes, I can see why they would be impacted. But NVIDIA specifically, as, you know, selling shovels to miners, right, selling pickaxes in the gold rush, like, people are still going to buy it no matter what model is being used.
Well, here's the thing. You know, the US government's worried about TikTok in terms of, you know, data harvesting. I mean, that's a walk in the park. That's nothing. Mm. That's chump change compared to what data can be harvested from DeepSeek.
Oh, yeah.
Yep. So, and they've also now released an image generator model as well, competing against your open sources and stuff. So,
yeah. And I can't help think, look, he's a conspiracy theorist in me, but I can't help think that this was released at a time to create maximum chaos. You know, you've already got, you know, we don't want to go and talk about Bezos and Melon Husk, you know, because we're not a political podcast. That's become politically hot at the moment. But, you know, you've got all that chaos going on. And then this gets released on, announced on top of it. Oh, boy.
Yeah.
What a crazy world we're in at the moment. And it's only been a week. Right. It's only been a week.
Anyway, exciting time.
Exciting times. And we did have, you know, a couple of stories here and to discuss, but that was, we put them in before this. So we'll talk about them still, but we'll see how relevant they are. But before we get onto that, we've got IDX. IDX, Ian. Chat, Gemini Chat is now in IDX. I'd never seen IDX before.
Neither had I. Yeah. You were talking, you're like, oh, yes, they've been working on this for years. Under. I'm like, yeah, it's like, what is this? I remember an old, like, Google Cloud IDE. I don't remember hearing of IDX before.
No, and you're like, oh, IDX, it's been IDX is fantastic. So IDX, for people who don't know, IDX is Google's fully integrated IDE on the web. Essentially, it's a version of OSS code, which is the coding editor that you see on GitHub and the coding editor you see when you fire up Cloud Shell Editor. It's exactly the same thing, but this one's fully integrated into Google's ecosystem. It's also now got interactive chat. So it's got Gemini's interactive chat built into it. And some of the really cool things you can do is, like, you might have a project that's got a Docker file, for instance, and you can just tell the chat to build and run the Docker file. And it'll come up with a command to do it. You click the run command in terminal, and off it goes and does it. You can do really cool setup steps. So we all know that bootstrapping a new project is just a pain in the backside. So you can tell the AI prompt to, hey, I need a new React application using TypeScript, and it'll go and create it. You can tell it, oh, I want to put Tailwind CSS into my app. So add Tailwind CSS to the app, and it will go and do all of the steps required to add Tailwind CSS to it. It is really quite a cool tool. I mean, Project IDX is a really cool tool, but adding Gemini to it just takes it to next level.
I'm just playing with this now. I mean, this is very funky.
Yeah. I've been using it for ages. Like, it came out, I think, a year before last. And it's still in preview, because it's like a full blown editor. But it's fantastic. I love it.
But very cool. It's idx.google.com. It's a full IDE, and the Gemini thing, you've got a little Gemini icon at the top. You click that, and there's a chat with Gemini drop down there. And I've got at the moment a split screen. I've got my code on the left and the Gemini chat on the right. And I guess my entire code base forms the context for the prompt, right?
Yeah.
And it can give me suggestions on what I need to do. That's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah, it's great. I love it.
Go and give that a go. And then we'll get on with the stories we were going to cover before the whole world blew up. Google pushes a global agenda to educate workers, lawmakers on AI. Getting more people and organizations, including governments, familiar with AI and using AI tools makes for better AI policy and opens up new opportunities. So it sounds like Google want to sell some AI to companies.
Well, yeah, they do, but I think they're also getting dragged across the coals because of AI. Because, you know, they control the AI, they control the browser that you're using it on, they control the web that you're searching for it on. There's so many different elements to this, and there's a lot of governments around the world that want to separate everything that Google does from everything else that Google does.
Mm-hmm.
And so they're trying to drum up support of a, hey, look, we're not being evil here. We're not Oracle. we're just trying to give you the best AI tooling possible.
Yeah, this is the business we're in.
Yep.
This is the technology we developed. You know, we're not trying to be do no evil.
Hmm.
This article does mention the US Department and the Dodge attempting to break up Chrome web browser away from Google as well. Though it may shift its course under the Trump administration, interestingly.
Yeah.
So I can say, this article also does go on to say that Google does expect a small fraction of jobs to be entirely displaced by AI. I think it's the first time I've seen that admittance in a document, but we know that's going to be the case anyway.
That was inevitable.
Yeah.
With every great advancement in technology, there is always a loser in the technology, and it's
a shift. Yeah,
yeah.
That's right.
But
the last line of this: the history of adult retraining is not particularly glorious. I found this is odd, right? Adults don't want to go back to class.
No.
Classroom training is not going to be the solution to a lot of retraining. You know what? Maybe I'm the minority, but I don't mind relearning retraining
to learn skills. So the majority of adults, once they've done their training and they've got qualified in whatever it is that they do, the vast majority of them don't want to go back to school and learn something different. Because the brain doesn't like doing that. The brain is a very, like, I know this and I'm going to stick to this. That's why people find it so hard to give up drinking and smoking and all of the vices that humans have got.
Yeah, it ossifies into that situation.
And just, you know, culturally as well, like a lot of people don't have that a growth mindset. Like knowing that you can be better, you can change, there's no reason why you can't. Like, things may be harder, and it can certainly be hard to switch back into a learning mode. But I think people can tend to do it, you know, if they get a mindset to do a career change, that something, they're like, I'm really just tired of this career that I found myself in. And that gives them an impetus to do it because, you know, I want something different. Mm-hmm. But to then shift it into it's like, well, you know, but you can kind of always be doing that. You can always be learning. You can always be better.
And I find a lot of people don't really understand the idea that when you're outside of your comfort zone is when you're learning stuff. Because if you're in your comfort zone, you're not learning anything.
No. And push the envelope.
Yeah. You've got to.
Yep.
Otherwise, you don't learn anything new.
That's when you're improving. Yep.
Yeah. You've got to try and learn something new every day, at least one thing.
Yep. No, I hear you. Mm. I hear you. But, you know, I don't think a lot of people think like that.
No, they
today
don't.
Today, I learned around IDX.
There you go.
There you go. Might even use it.
I am, actually.
I love it. I think it's fantastic.
And then finally to finish up the AI wars, and this has got a sting. This has got a sting, Google. Google reportedly pumps 1 billion more into Anthropic.
Yeah.
This is days before DeepSeek was announced.
If they'd waited, they could have spent like 500 million.
Yeah. The new deal would take Google's total investment into OpenAI rival to more than $3 billion in 2 years.
So, yeah, Google's or Alphabet have pumped $3 billion into Anthropic. Amazon's pumped $8 billion into Anthropic. So, I mean, there's a lot of money has gone into that company, and for good reason. Like, it's a good safety net around AI. But... yeah, the DeepSeek thing's got to really sting a little bit.
Reading up in the into the deal, and yeah, there's still more in there. I think there's like there's cash, but there's also computing credits.
Yeah,
that's a lot of investment is you will run it on Google Cloud.
I see. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And to go along with that, Amazon has also pumped $8 billion into Anthropic over the years. Starting with 1.25 initial investment in 2023, giving the e-commerce giant a minority stake in the business, and then a further 2.75 billion in March 24.
Yep, another 4 billion last November. There's a lot of billions there.
A lot of billions going into.
They've got a market valuation of I think 160 billion.
Well, they did.
They did. Yeah, they did. Maybe not anymore, you know. Thanks, DeepSeek.
$60 and a packet of chips.
See, you don't need to own the NVIDIA chips. You can just rent them off someone else.
Eh? Why buy the cow?
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, export sanctions on chips and tech like that. You don't need to get the export, be affected by them. Just hire the chips.
Yeah.
All right. Well, on that note, we might finish up the show for this fortnight. It's been a wild ride, you know, with what's happening in the US White House at the moment, and then DeepSeek being dropped right at the time to cause maximum chaos. Let's see
mission
what the next
achieved.
Fortnight brings us. Yeah. I'll continue my tech adventures and let you know how I go here with my old G5s. And Ian, we've got to get together because I got to get one of those up to you guys.
Oh, yeah.
Have a good week. Don't forget, you can find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and YouTube Music. Go to Apple Podcasts, write us a review. Go to YouTube, start the discussion. Always nice to chat to our listeners there. You can contact the show, contact@gcpbytes.com.au. You can find us on the web, www.gcpbytes.com.au. And today's sponsors were Hive Tech Solutions and Mantle Group. Well, that's about it from me. Anything else from you guys?
Nah, mate. I'm all done.
Nah, have a great
I've talked enough.
Right on time, too. We'll see you guys next fortnight. Bye.
Bye.
At GCB Bytes, we have no idea what's going on, just like the rest of the world. And I am your host, Stephen Bancroft. On today's show...
Oh, that's a good crack.
That was good.
Will that work? Will that
I like that.
I love it.